Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 974. Wow, 974. Slowly creeping our way to 1,000. When's that going to be? February? March? I don't know. I should have thought about it before I started talking about it. But if you want to think about something, you could think about submitting your event or thing you made to events@id10t.com. So that I can talk about it and let people know in the community that might want to check it out or support you, like Michael Height, who writes, "After too many years of reading, watching, and playing around with my food, my good friends Mike, Sarah, and I found something that we love to do each week, create stuff in the form of a podcast. We've decided to carve out a little place as a weekly podcast with a goal to help people get into cooking. Each week, we make food approachable by selecting one dish that makes cooking fun and easy. We post the recipes on our website, foodandfury.com, and rework recipes to make the kitchen less daunting while keeping our geeky movie and game references. For those who have spent a few hours in Azeroth, you might find familiar voice in our intro. We all eat. Let's eat something good together. Find us at foodandfury.com on Twitter and Instagram, Food and Fury Show, and check it out wherever you get your podcasts. It's time to gather your sword and board. Let's enter the kitchen with Food and Fury." Also, Andy Bergman. Oh, it's so hard not to say his name like Bergman. It's hard not to go Birdman on that. Andy, I apologize if that is something that people do at you all the time, thinking that they are original and doing it for the first time. Anytime you think you have some take on someone's name, you don't. They already have it. I know my last name, Hardwick, turns into really horrible things. I'm aware of that. And yet still people are like, hey, still, I'm in my 40s. And so are they. So maybe that's a little on them. And maybe this was a little on me. Andy Bergman. It just sounds so good. But the important thing is that Andy has created an amazing game that's on Kickstarter. It's called Yaz. Yaz is a totally unique new collaborative board game. Gameplay takes place in the ancient land of Yaz, where a band of characters sets out on an epic journey to navigate the terrain, collect gems, and become powerful enough to capture a treasure of golden riches from the castle of Yaz. It's a completely homegrown adventure game where every detail of the handcrafted experience has been meticulously designed, down to the felt-lined wooden box it lives in. Support Yaz on Kickstarter today and begin your adventure. I did. When he sent me this email, I went on, I looked at it, the game looks rad, and so I backed it on Kickstarter. Just go to Kickstarter and look for Yaz, A World of Adventure. So nice job, Andy. This episode is Ron Perlman, who we were trying to do the math, but we think it's the fourth time that he's been back on. I mean, why go back and look these things up, which would be so easy to do? Let's just say it's number four. But Ron, Uncle Ron, I like to call him Uncle Ron. He's the fucking best. God, I love that guy. He is promoting his new film, Asher, in theaters, VOD, and digital on December 7th, which has already happened, so that means it is out. So listen, Ron is huggable and amazing and, you know, and also a karaoke superstar. And maybe that turns up later in the podcast. And maybe I butcher part of it. But Ron's part is great. And in the end, isn't that all that really matters? Okay, you kids. Go on home. Okay. Here's the ID10T podcast number 974 with Ron Perlman.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
So appreciate your generosity here in getting this, banging this out.
I appreciate you. I think this is this your fourth appearance on the podcast? Fourth or fifth?
I can remember three others.
Yeah.
So, but there may have been another one.
There might have been another one. This is at least the fourth one.
I
mean, I feel like
You know, we should just start issuing badges to people, like Boy
Scout
badges. We don't
need no stinking badges.
Fair. Maybe that's what it should say. Do you want me to open that for you? There you go. Oh, you got it.
Just give me a second.
Before he just takes the bottle of water and smashes it on the table.
Nobody likes a wise ass. I'm going to open that for you. I was like 50-50. I should say yes.
But then you figured it out.
I thought I knew everything. And then I realized...
This was just the last thing that you didn't know, and now you've solved that.
So,
where do you go from here? Would you want to know everything there is to know about the universe, or do you feel like...
Oh, no. Are you kidding? I feel like I know way more than I... I'm not comfortable with what I know, and I don't know anything.
You're right.
But I'm really uncomfortable with what I do know.
Do you think we know too much as a... Information is good. For sure, information is good. But do you feel like we know too much about stuff because of... You know, just because of how freely available information is? Or do you think knowledge is always better?
No, I think that there's such a thing as sensory overload, and there's so much happening in the world that you want to be concerned about, but that you have no control over doing anything about to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those incidents that you have to process and deal with, and then come to the conclusion, like, I can't do a fucking thing about that to make that better.
Right.
To help those people, whatever, you know, the fires, for instance.
Right.
It kind of takes a little bit of something out of you, I feel. Like, I feel, and I've been hearing, visceral responses to, you know, the politics of the last 2 years, like people, you know, are seeing their shrink more often. You know, families are getting into places where they don't speak to each other anymore. You know, venerable old relationships are being destroyed. So, you know, you get to the point where if you are bombarded, and, you know, now that we're truly in this 24-hour news cycle, and we have more networks and channels and things to fill up than we ever had before. Plus, that's not even counting the internet, you know.
Right.
Which we have inured ourselves to in a way where it's become indispensable, or at least we think it has. There's desensitizing?
Mm-hmm.
What's the word?
That was the word. Yeah, we're desensitized to all of the...
That is not useful, I don't think. It's not useful. And you know, some people are more well-armed to deal with these slings and arrows than others. But it's a good recipe for if you're a little bit, you know, like, you know, somebody whose balance can be fucked with. It's a recipe for having a profound effect on things that you have no control over, or that's kind of none of your business. Then it should.
Yeah, I mean, I
didn't expect to go doom and gloom on you this quickly in the interview.
Yeah, I know, but we'll be at dick jokes in no time. 24.
No time whatsoever. That was our first one, right?
The physical.
Congratulations. You got
you know,
it in.
You know what?
You got it in there, didn't you?
The podcast.
I have faith in you.
The podcast doesn't. It's the one unfortunate thing about not doing videos. People couldn't see the comedy take. You took a beat holding your water. You stared at me and then took a sip. It was so flawlessly executed and lost on the audio podcast experience. Lost.
But we knew it happened.
You and I knew it happened.
Which is why this is my fourth time here, is because we really don't give a fuck what anybody thinks. We're just going to keep talking and say nothing to each other.
That's exactly right. But, Ron, some of my favorite podcasts of the entire series of this podcast have been with you because of the...
I appreciate that. And vice versa. This is far and away. You know, it was my very first ever... I didn't know what a podcast was.
Really?
The first time.
Oh, my gosh.
You're my very first podcast.
I didn't know that.
Now, I mean, look at what you've spawned.
Look what I've done. Do you do podcasts? Are you seeing other podcasts, Ron Perlman?
I'm the only one that I know that doesn't have his own podcast.
It's been, and soon that should, I feel like that should, we think we talked about this the last time you should do a podcast, and you're like, what the fuck am I going to talk about? I don't know.
I'm not really good at giving a shit about what anybody else thinks, which is why, like, what you do is like, you know, you're able to, like, the really great podcasters and interviewers in general, they have a space somewhere inside of them where they're really curious about what other people think and feel. I'm not that guy. I just, you know, I don't give a fuck what you're going through right now. I don't want to know what you think about anything, but I'm so grateful you're asking for my opinion, because that I really care about.
That's why you don't have guests on. You just do like a 10-minute monologue. Your podcast is just be like 10, 12 minutes of just like, you know, like a weekly dose of Perlman.
That's the best pitch I've gotten so far today anyway.
That's all you need. It doesn't have to be an hour. You don't have to talk to anybody. It can be, you know, like one week could be like some in-depth thing about politics. The next one could just be about, you know, a bowl of cornflakes that you had that you were either happy or angry about. It doesn't matter. And you could bang them all out pretty quickly. I think the world would appreciate a Perlman cast. That's all.
Thank
just
you.
Sit with it.
Well, the thought is beautiful. It'll never happen.
But it may
actually, because I see great value. You know, getting back to what we were just talking about, where, you know, you're absorbing all this stuff, and you don't have an outlet for it.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to your friends is the ultimate salve.
I think it's sove.
How do you spell it? S-A-L-V-E.
Yep.
Salve.
Spoken like a true spelling bee champion.
Yeah, I think the L is silent.
Salve. It's a healing salve. Scars of the soul.
How does an L be silent?
Salve.
But I do. I feel like collegiality is truly the answer. And sitting around, getting shit off your chest, and, you know, like talking to your friends, like, how you doing with this? What's going on with you with all this stuff?
But in the real world, like getting together in the physical universe and talking to people.
But whenever I do a podcast with you, I walk away feeling like I just had an exchange with somebody who, you know, sometimes thinks the way I do, but sometimes doesn't. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's just the human contact of it all is useful.
Yeah, our techno world is very isolating, and it's very easy to, because you don't really have to leave your house for anything. You know, you can send people direct messages, people deliver groceries to you, you can play a game, like, you don't need to do anything. And when you start, but when you do force yourself to go out, shut your phone off, talk to people, experience something, you do feel this very primal, like, oh, I think this is what I'm supposed to do more often. I think this is actually how I'm supposed to, maybe not for, you know, the Generation Z, the little kids now, because, you know, they were born into this techno world, but certainly those of us who remember a pre-techno world, you know, like, maybe this is what we're supposed to do more often.
Mm. Well, it works, and you go, geez, why don't I do that more often? And then you just go back to your horrible, shitty piece of shit private life, where, you know, you just pull down the shades and
fuck off on the door, and shut the door,
and you know, just cut off any opportunity for human contact whatsoever.
But it's not. You were right about. I mean. It's then. It's even more than just a 24-hour news. Like CNN sort of created, like cable news created the 24-hour news cycle. Now we're in a 360-degree news cycle, because at least the 24-hour news cycle from 20 years ago, you had to go to seek it out, and now it's just you. It's just everywhere. Everywhere you turn is a news cycle, and it's really hard to get away from it. And it's also. We have to remind ourselves that while it is important to hear about what's going on in the world, it is all still, like, for commercial purposes, you know? Like, our kind of our emotions and our outrage are really kind of being farmed for ads, you know, for clicks and sponsorships and stuff. And it's why it's important to unplug that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're coming after our credit card numbers, man. That's all we are.
Are you still yelling at people on Twitter? How you doing with Twitter?
I've gotten to the point where I'm a little bit... The short answer is yes.
Okay.
I'm never going to stop yelling at people in whatever outlet I have for that.
Good.
And Twitter is the easiest now that they've gone to 280 characters.
Man. Oh, wow. It's like you've doubled your productivity.
I feel like I'm writing the Declaration of Independence every fucking day. Like, this is a doctrine. This is no longer a tweet.
Chapter one.
This is a doctrine. This is important.
Mm-hmm.
Like, This should be chronicled.
Yeah.
No, the Chronicles of Rondia.
Oh, that's your podcast name. You just fucking came up with the name. It's sort of like, you know, you named a goat, you know? Like you named a cow. Now you can't kill it. Now you got to live with it.
I thought the name that I came up with for my very first foray into social media was, because I was one of those guys, you know, I mean, I thought the word tweet and the act of tweeting and the notion of Twitter had connotations that were like, did not match my self-imposed.
A little precious, a little tweet.
My self-imposed version of my own manhood.
Right. I'm so mad I'm going to tweet about this.
Yes. Yeah, so I just didn't. And I was one of those guys that said, yeah, I'll, you know, over my fucking dead body. And I happened to be in an environment where all my friends who I thought were like, you know, never going to succumb to it, all started getting on social media. And, you know, and then so in order for them to justify their piece of shit, you know, existences, they just want, you know, misery loves company. So they now want to recruit, you know, whatever cool guy is left in the group, like who's not on Twitter,
right?
We got to get him on,
yeah,
because that'll make us feel,
yeah, know. Let's ruin his life too.
And so, how am I coming out into this world? And Pearl Mutations,
I remember,
which is my handle. I thought I couldn't do better than that, but the Chronicles of Rondia. I don't know where that sounds a little.
Chronicles of Rania. It'd be Rania. Wouldn't it be Rania?
Rania.
Yeah, Chronicles of Rania. I mean, you could call it Permutations just to keep it consistent with the Twitter account.
No, that's done already.
Chronicles of Rania is pretty great.
That's a conquered world, Chris. We have many worlds.
Chronicles
left
of Rania
to
is great. Yeah, and that's the idea behind the C.S. Lewis novels. There are many worlds, many realities, many pools to jump in. And also, Chronicles of Rania is just about whatever you're kind of dealing with that day, the big ticket items, little ticket items, you know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just think about it. I just think it's a thing people would want.
You're selling me here.
And you could record it in no time. Like, it wouldn't take any time. You know, you travel a lot, you know, like if you're bored in a hotel room, I don't know. It just, you know, just fucking record it into your phone. You have a studio in your pocket, Ron. You could fucking do this. No problem.
So for those of you who, you know, are only imagining what, you know, what it's like to sit across the table from Chris here and do this. He's got world-class mics on incredibly cute, very effective stands with what do you call these cables? Something cables?
These are XLRs.
XLR cable.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, can I have all this stuff? Would you bequeath me this so that I can actually, you know,
would I bequeath it to you? That's what you said.
Bequeath.
Okay, bequeath. That's much different. If you started a podcast.
If you wanted to bequeath it to me.
I'll bequeath it to you. Yeah, I'll bequeath.
I'm just kidding. I'm
telling you, if you agreed to do it, I would send you a recorder as a gift.
I'd get my starter kit.
I would give you the podcast starter kit.
All right, I'm going to leave my address at the door before I leave.
You know what you can get, actually, is that Zoom, the company that makes the recorders make a really cool, like microphones that you just plug into your phone, and it makes your phone sound like these microphones.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, well then, fuck it. Keep these.
Okay. Oh, now you're giving back the starter kit.
Nah, way too cumbersome.
You're right. All you need to do is carry a microphone around, and when you get pulled over, you know, like when TSA pulls it out and go, what's this? You go, I'm a fucking podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
Chronicles of Rania.
Be careful how you, with that cavity search you're about to do, sir. Because this is all being recorded.
I know.
I got a camera coming out of my appendix.
I know it's weird to put a camera in my
in my appendix.
But I'm a podcaster.
Because I never knew what my appendix was useful for. Now I found the ultimate way.
As a storage locker, using it as a storage locker,
and also 3D.
Are you traveling a lot this year? You said you were going to Cape Town.
I'm about to go. To Cape Town later in the week to do a little picture for Sony called Monster Hunter with the beautiful Mila Jovovich.
Oh, yeah.
And the scintillating Tony Jaa, my little brother.
Nice.
My little Thai brother. I'm for some strange reason, 2018 was like, it seemed like I was 52 weeks on the road.
Yeah.
One way or another. No, I got nothing.
Do you kind of have that John Wick existence where you're constantly like, I just want to retire and be, and then you get the call and they're like, we need you in this. And you're like, fuck. All right. One more. I'll do one more. But then that just keeps going.
I'm the guy who, for the first almost 50 years of his life, just wanted to work all the time and couldn't get arrested. I mean, I did a couple of really cool things, in my 20s and 30s and 40s. But I really didn't get going until I was like around 50, where, there was a real kind of a frenzy, like a regularity to my being employed. And I'm at this point now where, I'm making up for all that downtime that I had. Mm-hmm. So I can't say no. I say yes to everything. Like, I'll go shopping for you.
Yep.
If the price is right. Like, yep. I'll go to Gelson's for you and pick up all your forget Amazon. Ranazan
or Amaron. Amaron Fresh. That would be amazing if you just showed up at someone's house with a bunch of groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's your groceries. Oh, you forgot the... I don't give a fuck.
Who got the large curd cottage cheese? Was that you? You look like a small curd kind of guy. Did I misjudge you?
Someone's not going to shit for a week. Anyway. What, no tip? Piece of shit.
No, the tip's included. Don't worry about that, pal. They don't call me Perlman for nothing. I got that all wired.
You have that figured out.
Yeah, that's hardwired, baby.
Did you take any time for yourself?
30%.
30%? Okay. 30% markup?
Yeah.
You know what? It's worth it. If you showed up at the door, it's worth it.
I got jokes.
And when you don't?
And when I don't, give me 30% anyway. Who gives a fuck?
Did you take any time for yourself this year at all? Like in this sort of like frenzy to do all the jobs?
Well, the funny thing is that the work itself, like everything that I've been doing, which seems, you could interpret it any number of ways, but my love, my joy is being on a movie set with people who blow my mind about how cool and talented they are, and we're solving the problem of making this movie, and hopefully maybe even we're making something cool. That still is like being on vacation for me. Mm-hmm. That's like my version of going to, Bali and soaking up the sun and hanging out with who do you hang out with in Bali?
The Balinese?
Yeah. There you go. I knew he'd know. What else do I need for you to tell me?
I don't know. I'm here.
But anyway, but airplanes are like, I'm finding out, are very unhealthy. Like the air in an airplane is not real air.
That recycled.
Yeah, it's just shit. And then, that whole pressurized, depressurized, unpressurized, 35,000 down to 28 because it's turbulent. It's a drag. So that part, that's the trade-off. The trade-off is like I'm a little burnt out from what you have to do to go to have all of the nachas and the joy and the good luck and the good fortune and the great memories that I'm getting to have by doing all this stuff. So, but I don't dare ask God to, like, you know, lighten up on the opportunities, because, you know, it's I know what famine is like, and I'm happy to be part of the feasting.
Yeah, I know you got to catch yourself complaining. Oh, I can't believe I got to. I'm fine. It's fine. You need to make sure the universe hears you. No, I'm fine. I don't mean to complain.
I'm really good.
It is kind of funny that people do complain about being on a set. They're like, yeah, you know, you just sit in your trailer most of the time. But it seems like, well, you know, you'd have some time to yourself. You can read. You could learn your lines. You could figure out how to be a better person. You could learn a language. It seems like you could do a lot in, you know.
I personally nap.
You could nap as much as possible.
Napping in my trailer is, no one will ever know how many hours I've spent asleep.
Because in a 13, like, let's say you're in like a, well, let's say like a 13-hour day on set. How much of that time are you actually doing the thing you're paid to do?
It varies. I mean, there's no real right answer to that. I mean, there are certain DPs that I've worked with, you know, who the ratio of how long it takes for them to light a scene and the amount of time it takes to shoot that scene is like 8 to 1.
Right.
The DP is lighting.
Right.
You know, and then you're on, you know, and on those movies, I have never looked better. I mean, I'm so well rested. Like, you know,
well, you're napping. Yeah,
there's no bags under my eyes. You know, I'm like, I got pep in my step. It's beautiful. But then there are days when you just can't wait to get off set because you're just like, you know, you're just there, like, you know, relentlessly. You know, the only break you get is lunch. Either way is fine with me.
Have you ever been in a situation where you're shooting and you're just tired and you kind of don't feel like being there, and in your mind you're sort of just phoning in all your lines, and then you see the movie and you go, I was actually pretty good in that.
Yeah, no, it took me 50 years to realize the power of phoning it in.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, people you know, now that I've, like, you know, entered into the autumn of my years.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 45. No.
We gotta do a little karaoke.
I just did. But anyway, you know, when I was younger, I didn't appreciate the actors that I do now. Like, you know, everybody said, well, John Wayne, you know, he's the biggest box office star. He's not acting. He's just being himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me like a long, long, long time to realize how hard it was to do that, to be so natural on screen that no one thinks you're acting.
Yeah.
That everybody just thinks you're saying these lines because they're your lines and you're saying them the way you... I mean, yeah. No, that's like the art of it all is to disappear completely into the guy so that you know, there's no effort.
Right.
And so my version of a great performance, you know, at my age now is different than it was when I was in my 20s and 30s. You know, people were doing all these gyrations and you know, shaking their ass and, you know, just being like, holy shit, that's like, he should be on the Sullivan Show. That's like a variety act. You know, and now I'm like, I'm looking at Ray Milland and going, he's not doing anything. He's just breathing. You can't take your eyes off him, though, because it's like when you see something that's that authentic and that simple and that human and that pure, that's what we're looking for. You
know? Yeah, because when you're the tap dancing you're talking about that people do, like what we all do when we're young, we're thinking, look at me, look at me, look at me. And if you're thinking, look at me, then you're thinking about the external world. Yeah. You're thinking about other people. You're thinking, thinking about, you're not being centered and focused. And then I think when you get older, you just don't care. You know, it's like, I don't care, you know, so you let all that go.
and then you like the I can't tell this story. It would be insulting to one of the people in the story, and I never do. I never want to insult one of my fellow performers. But I learned a lesson. I watched. I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with Sinatra in the last 10 years of his life, because mm-hmm. he used to throw this charity tournament every year, and he'd perform at it. And he always had two acts that opened, and then he would on the Saturday night of this tournament, it would be like this amazing show. And the two acts that preceded him made every move you could fucking make. I mean, you know, they were wrapping the mic around their neck, and, you know, the wire. They had dance moves. They had, you know, it was flawless, you know. And it was putting me to sleep. And then Sinatra would come on stage, and he was so old and so fighting with dementia already that all he could do was basically sit there and not move. And you couldn't take your eyes off him. And it was one of the great lessons in performing is, like, it's not about, you know, it's not about anything other than presence. You know, he was just not doing a thing.
But he had to work for that many decades to get to that point.
He was one of those guys that had the secret from the get-go. I mean, you know, he always knew about the simplicity of it all. But as he got older, as we all get older, we just tend to understand that it's... You know, it's the simplicity.
I heard a story about I was in a book I was reading, and it was I think it was, you know, Picasso when he was older, you know, much older. He was in a cafe and he was doodling on a napkin, and this woman came up to him and she was like, "Oh, can I have that? Can I have that doodle?" He crumpled it up. He's going to throw it away. She goes, "I'll pay you for it." And he goes, "Okay, $20,000. And she's like, "What? It took you like a minute to draw that." And he said, "No, it took me 60 years. And then she obviously wasn't going to pay the 20 grand. So he just put the napkin in his pocket and walked out. It's like, yeah, it takes that, you know, to master a craft. You know, it's not just, it's the sum total of everything that you had to go through to get to that point.
Right.
But you think Sinatra was there from day one. I mean, obviously he was, you know, I know he was a heartthrob in the, you know, in the 30s. You know, he had the, just that, even a different vocal quality than I think what people tend to think of a Sinatra song. He had a real fluid, beautiful voice. And then later on, this guy, you know, he didn't have that voice when he was in his 30s. And cigarettes probably.
Cigarettes and Jack Daniels
took some of that away, mm-hmm. but he was almost never not.
I call the early period his Boy Scout.
He was, yeah, exactly. It's like bright blue eyes
and every girl, you know, the whole thing about the Bobby Soxers and women screaming, because he was like the first artist that they screamed over. You know, everybody thought it was like Elvis and the Beatles. No, it was Frankie Boy back in the 40s, because they all just wanted to fuck him. Like he was this innocent, you know, wide-eyed kid that weighed about 67 pounds.
Yeah, he was a wisp of a guy.
And he was just, like, his voice was angelic. He hadn't ravaged it yet with, you know...
with life.
the booze and the broads and, you know, hanging with Dino and Sammy and Joey and, you know, Peter. So that was his Boy Scout period. But there was this thing that went all through all the period, because I'm obsessed with Sinatra. And I really, really never stopped studying him, because every single time I hear a performance that I've been listening to literally my whole life, because Sinatra was the background music of me growing up. My dad was a musician back in the swing days. So his heroes were Tommy Dorsey and Harry James, the guys who taught Frank all that genius that he had about phrasing, about the way he breathed, which is what colored his artistry to such a great degree. And there was also this simplicity that made it look like he was hardly working. But now that I'm listening to things that I've actually heard over 1,000 times, I'm still hearing, holy shit, That was a choice he made, that phrasing. That was he conceived how long he was going to hold that note, or how long he wasn't going to hold that note, or whether he was going to modulate. And I mean, it's like Frank is like musically like Mozart, you know, like he's that sophisticated. He was in that much control of his artistry. But we're not here to talk about fucking Frank.
I do want to talk about fucking Frank for a sec, because I think he's an interesting case study. Do you think he died happy? Do you think he was happy in his life, in his later life?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about us artists is that, you know, I'm really happy, but I think that what makes me want to be an artist is that part of me that's unhappy,
the discomfort,
and angry, and you know, feels like, you know, we're so far from being in a world that's just and fair, you know, and that's what feeds my you know, desire to keep going. Frank was capable of this horrific bouts of you know, almost suicidal. You know, he was so romantic. You know, he got, you know, like all those ballad albums from the 50s, Wee Small Hours of the Morning, you know, When No One Cares and all that stuff. That was him just having his guts ripped out by Ava Gardner and other things. You know, the business was fucking with him, you know. So these guys look like they have perfect lives because they're rich and they're on the top of the food chain. But, you know, they're processing the slings and arrows in the same way we are, just in a different lens and through a different set of circumstances. And therein lies their genius. It's the funky shit that makes them great.
Right.
And, you know, it's like when I wrote my memoir, there was stuff pouring out of me that I wasn't even aware that I felt like. But what I realized when I was writing it was I never learned anything when things were going smoothly. I never, you know, improved as a human being when everything was good. You know, the only time, you know, I learned anything or added a new set of bullets to my arsenal was when I was on the balls of my ass and everything was going badly and I was having to dig my way out of it. You know, if you're gaining any character at all in this life, you know, there's no guarantee of that. It's only going to come from, you know, getting punched square in the nose and then having to get back up and say, fuck this, man, I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah, it's so, I mean...
And Frank was, you know, if you really, you know, research, he was a guy who felt everything very, very, very deeply. And I feel as though there's a complete balance. Like the reason why the genius was as articulated as it was because that's how sad he was.
Mm-hmm.
It came in exact equal measure. And he was able to use his art form as a way, it's like therapy, as a way to exercise his demons, to get them out, to put them out into the universe where they could be explored and dissected and maybe even, you know, diffused.
Yeah, we're such a therapied culture now. I wonder if Frank would even be able to exist fully in this reality because he'd have therapy from an early age and wouldn't necessarily, you know. I mean, I don't know if the trade-off is worth it to be that much of a genius, but to have that sort of like, you know, epic level of inner torment at the same time. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if it's worth it. I just think it's, you know, I mean, it's funny to say like, well, I hope he found some happiness when you think like, what, he had everything in the world. But yeah, those were all things, you know, like his career maybe was, would you say it was like just a search for something, some kind of stability, something kind of real to hold on to?
Yeah, and I think it was probably just a search to be at peace, you know, in a body that was tormented by one thing or another because of how he processed life. He goes on stage and sings those songs and connects with thousands of people who are behind the floodlights, who he can't really see, but he can feel them. That's when I'm at peace. You know, that's why I perform, is because I'm doing something that is, you know, I've taken away all the funkiness of what the creative process was, and now I've arrived at this thing that's refined and make believe, and there's no problems. It's good, and that's what all of us are partially being fed by. You know, those of us who self express as their way of getting through life.
Maybe there's a so maybe once you get your podcast up and running. Maybe there's a...
Yeah, I changed my mind. Fuck that shit.
What? That was it? Wow, that was quick. I was going to say, maybe there's
I'm getting it all off my chest right now.
By the time you leave, you're like, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a Springsteen-style show for you where you just tell stories and then sing Sinatra songs. I mean, you tell good stories.
I mean, look, is Springsteen doing Sinatra in his Broadway act?
God, no, he's doing Springsteen in his act, but I mean...
But Bob Dylan's doing like one Sinatra song after another, and he's in his 70s, and so... My conclusion is that no matter how angry you were starting out, no matter how much shit you had on your foot that you had to get off and shit, you know, everybody ends up being Sinatra. You know, Joni Mitchell, like, you know, last couple of, it was all Sinatra stanzas she recorded with this huge orchestra. Like, everybody ends up going that way, you know.
Well, because I think...
Linda Ronstadt, you know.
You know what? I tend to think that, you know, there's a certain amount of like hunger and fire that you have to be an artist, to want to. Ron's just having a pee break.
Actually, I feel so much better now.
There's a certain amount of.
I'm really glad. I'm really thankful that these new catheters are so.
They're so. They just go right in. Yeah, they just go right in.
Hang on, I'm changing.
Oh, there it is. Oh. Nice.
I think I put that one in too deep.
Nice.
Ooh, I can feel that in my back of my throat.
When I was 17. I just think with Sinatra songs, like when you're young, you have the fire and you have the hunger and you want to express the discomfort. And then you get older and these people still want to perform. And so they probably just feel like, well, these songs have the most, like, it's sort of a proxy. It's like, I don't feel like digging and going through the torment of writing soulful, gut-wrenching music anymore. So I'm just going to take the gold standard, just Frank. And I'm going to do these songs because I feel a lot of these things and I have a different perspective on what these were. Like you said, when you hear new things, you have a different perspective as you get older. And it's just sort of like it allows them to express those things without having to go through the torment of creating those things. Because Joni, she just had her 75th birthday. They did a couple shows here in L.A. We were out of town, so we didn't get to go.
Oh.
And I know she showed up for one night. But I don't know if she performed, but it was just like this incredible, like the people who performed her songs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen anyone live recently? Do you go out to live shows anymore?
No. Everybody I've seen is dead.
Then what if we just ended there? We just ended the podcast.
Well, good to see you, Chris.
Good to see you too.
This has been really nice.
Your catheter. You just hear them pop out as you walk away. How many, you said you worked with Sinatra near the last couple of years of his life?
Didn't work with him, but he when he married Barbara, she was very philanthropic. And so he started this golf tournament to help raise funds for all of her charities.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always throw this thing, in Palm Springs or Palm Desert or whatever. And I went to all of them. They were always in like late January and stuff. And it would be 2 days of golf and, you know, a Friday and a Saturday. And then Saturday night was a black tie dinner at which Tom Treason would open. And then there'd be, you know, either Stephen Eady or Tony Bennett or Liza Minnelli and then Frank performing. So it was a real special little weekend. But it was the last years of Sinatra. And Sinatra, you know, went in and out of dementia toward the end. So there were certain nights when you got Sinatra at his very, 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 very sharpest, finest. And then there were certain other nights where he kind of was like a little confused and couldn't find the teleprompter because, you know, he needed the teleprompter for the lyric. So it was like, for somebody like me who's obsessed with that kind of greatness and who wants to study all of it, you know, the good parts and the stinky parts alike, you know, because you're going to like get an insight into like his humanity, which I'm obsessed with. This was just like a privilege to be able to just, and he got to know me. He kept seeing me year in and year out, and you know, we had a couple of moments and stuff, and so, but I didn't take advantage like I should have of hanging out with Frank.
I think you probably did what you felt was right at the time.
I was, you know, it's like, for sure, like, I'm not worthy. Like,
well, what are you supposed to, you know,
Sinatra.
It's like, I, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, it's, especially with people like that, with meeting your idols, there's probably that, like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where you're like reaching for the chalice, like I can reach it, it's right there. No, don't let it go. You know. That if you tried to get too close, like everyone's trying to, you know, like I don't know. It sounds like you had the moments you were supposed to have with him. Mm. But how are you? I mean, to have someone who's that solidified in your life, in your psyche, in your mind, in your philosophy. I mean, the first time you met him, were you able to?
No, I was. I forgot my own name. It's a pretty cool story, which I've told a million times, so I'm not going to tell it again. But it was definitely like I'm not worthy. I'm like, let me get the fuck out of here. You're Frank Sinatra, and I just need to leave. Okay, if my dad could see me shaking your hand, that's all I needed right here today. And I said some stupid ass shit about, you know, like fans do that, and I just said to myself, don't hang out here. All it's going to do is you're gonna regret every single minute of the longer you spend, you know, with shit running down your leg because you're with Frank Sinatra, the worse this memory is going to become. So I just got the fuck out. And then I would see him over and over again at these, because the first time I met him was with Sammy at a rehearsal for that big show that they did, that last show that they took all over the world, Frank, Dean, and Sam together again, right before they all passed away. So that was my first meeting with him. But anyway.
Did you meet it, and you knew Sammy too?
Sammy was we were friends. Sammy was my way in to meet Frank.
How was Sammy? He seemed like the sweetest fucking guy, the best.
You know, it was like everybody thought he was a cliche, the peace, love, brotherhood, Sammy. You know, like he was just too good to be true. And then you meet him and you realize that's really who he is. He's the nicest, sweetest, most generous human you've ever met. And beautiful, beautiful dude. And the greatest entertainer.
How was Dino? Did you meet Dino?
Didn't really get a lot of time with Dino. Dino was keeping to himself in his latter years. You know, he had lost his son.
Yeah.
He never recovered from that. And everybody was close to him. Said, hey, you know, that's, you're never going to get to know the Dino that used to exist. The minute his son died, he just basically became a walking corpse and just waited for the end.
Jesus.
Never recovered from that. Which says a lot about him, you know. losing his son is like, here's this guy that has this patina around him where he's so handsome and he's got a drink in his, drink in his hand all the time. He's in Vegas. You got to feel like he's fucking 18 girls a night.
Yeah.
He loses his son and he becomes a complete vegetable. So he wasn't the guy that he projected. He was this beautiful family guy who felt things as deeply as you can feel things, which is why you never know, you know, when you're looking at somebody who looks like they got the world on a string and they're sitting on a rainbow, got the string around their finger.
I was backing track for it. I was doing backing track.
I got that.
I feel like there still has to be a karaoke song at some point in this, by the end of this podcast.
You know, how much time we got?
Hours, if you'll sing a song. I have one in mind. I know I'm going to pull up a karaoke thing, and then we'll just sort of splice it in. And you can, you know, you can do it or not do it. It's totally up to you.
Thank you. I love America, don't you? So many choices. So little time.
What are you particularly happy about now? Like, what are you excited about in the world? I know, you know, I get the sense that you feel like there's a lot of shit that's going on, but something, you know, like you have to have solace in something. Like, what makes you happy now?
Oh, my family is beautiful. My kids are beautiful. The time I get to spend with them is golden. They both turned out to be. I have a son and a daughter and a son, really, in that order. And they both turned out to be humans that I'd rather spend time with them because I laugh harder and I'm more amused with them than I am with pretty much any of my other friends. So that's a good one. That's a good thing. You know, I think we've probably touched on this in some of our other visitations, but started my own little movie studio about 6 years ago, and we've now produced about 9 movies, and we're doing really, really good with that. And, you know, it's me being able to look at this thing that I have this unbelievable reverence for, which is cinema, but through a completely different lens. I mean, when you're producing something, you're involved in all aspects of the raising up of this thing. Whereas when you're acting, you're mostly sleeping in your trailer. So I'm really digging on that, and I'm grabbing huge amounts of joy and pride and satisfaction from doing that. In fact, I think the reason why I've been booked to talk to you here is because we have one of our little movies coming out now called Asher, which opens worldwide on December 7th, both in theaters and video on demand. Produced that. I star in that, and I'm very proud of that. It's probably the project that we made, our little company made, that I'm probably most proud of. And I'm happy to, you know, be here with you, you know, celebrating that. And I'm just at this place where I feel as though there's huge bounty on my table. You know, I'm in the middle of this feast, this cosmic Thanksgiving. But it's 24/7. You know, it's like if they're lucky, get to do it once a year. And this is like my morning, noon, and night is like this grand bouff, you know, and it's got all of this creativity. It's got phenomenal folks that I'm, you know, getting to, people I've known for a long time that I'm getting to see lots of, and new people are coming into it. So very alive and very in a state of real gratefulness, real grace. And now if we could just get rid of this, this orange, you know, aberration, everything would be Jake, baby, as my dad used to say.
Everything would be Jake?
That's an old, like, 30s or 40s expression. Everything's Jake. How you doing? Everything's Jake.
Everything's Jake. It's all good.
Yeah, that's it.
It's all fine.
Yeah.
When did your dad did music his whole life?
No, he didn't. He only did it as a very young man, and then the minute he started having kids, he realized he couldn't make a living doing it and put food on the table, so he gave it up. And so he, you know, it was like one of these unfinished dreams. He died at 49, 1969. Whoa, I was 19. So my relationship with him is more like, you know, like this thing that I carry around with me that you can't see, touch, or smell. But he's, you know, very much all of the muses. What was my point about that?
We're talking about ice.
Yeah, and the great connection there is that I hung in there, whereas I got to watch a man who loved something like music, and then had to leave it because he felt like it couldn't sustain him. And he just needed to segue into something that was palpably more able to put food on the table for his burgeoning young family. And I always thought, oh, man, what would life have been like if my dad got to spend his whole life doing what he loved, which was music? That was his, you know, that's where he was like 110% alive. You know, everything else he did, he was like, very positive dude, so he was always like in the high 80s and sometimes in the low 90s. But when he was playing piano or drums, or he taught himself how to play trumpet, he taught himself how to play a million things, he was 110% alive. And as somebody like me who has spent my whole life doing what I love, you know, which is, you know, working as an actor, you just wish that for the people that, you know, that shaped you.
Yeah. But in a way, you got to do that. And so you're sort of carrying his dream through you. He made the choices that he made, and that allowed you to be the person that you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to do that stuff. So
yeah.
What a tremendous way to honor him in a way.
Clearly. And, you know, it was, even though he's been gone since 69, huge connection has remained. And so I'm pretty sure he's like looking down and going, attaboy.
Nice
and
job.
And that makes me really happy.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we're coming up. I guess it's Friday. Friday is the anniversary of my dad dying 5 years ago on Friday. But I had him until he was 72,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I was lucky that I had him for that long. But
yeah,
it does,
yeah.
You know, it does make you reflective. It definitely makes you reflective.
But all this stuff, I mean, just to put a reference to it all is like all the stuff that you and I have been talking about, including dick jokes and everything like that, and Sinatra and love for movies, that was all given to me by him. Those were the things that he loved. Nobody loved Sinatra more than my old man. Nobody understood why he loved Sinatra more than my old man. And same thing with movies. I mean, I used to sit there and watch Red River, you know, and Adventures of Robin Hood. These were his favorite movies and movie stars, Gable and Tracy and Jimmy Cagney and Eddie G. Robinson and Barbara Stanwyck and, you know, Coop. You know, Bogey, and he gave me all that. So there was this amazing torch that was passed on to me, you know, and it was a fully like, pay attention to this shit, kid. This is important, you know, and it turns out it was, you know, because in the big picture, you're saying like, what makes you happy, Ron? That's the shit that still does. That's the stuff that makes life worth living. And it's like, I in honor of the great Stan Lee.
Yes.
I just tweeted out one of the many beautiful quotes this morning. It was a Stan Lee quote. And I think it was from the 60s where he said, I always was kind of like disappointed that I didn't go into something important like medicine or law or teaching. And then one day I realized how much people love to be entertained. And it was like this, he finally understood the nobility of storytelling. And I thought that was, you know,
I mean, when you,
a great way to remember Stan.
I wrote a little thing about him too. And because when you think about the things that came out of that guy's head, I can't even imagine our culture without that.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy who probably in the early days just felt like, I don't know, no one's really, who gives a crap about, and billions of people, multi-generations, for generations to come, he's already legendary, and he, like, that guy's name will live on. You know, in 500 years, and they look back at the same way that we look back at creators of, you know, like artists and creators, his name will be synonymous with that. I mean, he just, his whole persona, everything about him, even his stage persona versus like the guy that I suspect that he was, who was a very, you know, like sweet, soft, quiet guy, mm-hmm. as opposed to the, hey, everybody, you know, like that big character. I loved both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like that guy was just he was just such a sweetheart.
Yeah. And you can see, by the way, this is the one thing that social media is really good for, because we've lost in just the last 2 years, like, you know, Prince and David Bowie and George Michael. And, you know, we've lost
Bourdain.
Bourdain and, you know, you can, and Aretha, and you can see in real time because of how, you know, the response, what people are sharing about what these figures meant to them on social media. And Stan Lee is, you know, the way that he's being remembered and honored by so many people who matter and who count. Everybody is like weighing in on this loss, and it's he would have liked it.
Of course he would have.
There's a lot of people that really would have dug being at their own memorial, like, hey, that fight, I didn't realize it. I guess I was pretty cool at the
end of the day, you know? I mean, there was a little, you know, he was sort of like I don't know, he's like a little bit of P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of Hefner, you know, a little bit like that kind of slick, and then a little bit of, you know, and then, but then he ultimately had the heart of a nerd. Like he's just a great, just a good, solid guy. But it, and to think that, I mean, you talk about how your career really kind of hit when you were in your 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, He always had stuff going on, but it was really, I mean, I would almost say when he was about 70 is when it really all like started to take off,
yeah.
You know? I mean, he was always legendary to a certain group up to that point, but you know, when the Marvel stuff started going really big cinematically and it became, you know, very multi-generational and it was like the last 25 years of his life.
Yeah.
You just don't ever know. And it does, you know, for anyone who's struggling or feels like they don't have what they want right now or this, it's like, you know, just enjoy the fucking process. You never know when it's going to hit
know.
And you just got to enjoy all of it.
You never know.
All of it.
Yeah.
Well, I want to pull this up. I mean, I know what I want to find. Let's see.
You want to take the first one?
No, you do it.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year.
for small town girls and soft summer nights. We'd hide from the lights on the village green. When I was 17.
That's all I got.
When I was 21.
No, you're early, you're early.
Oh, sorry.
This is the segue.
I'm too young. That's a problem.
Here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
And
when I was 21, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stair. With all that perfumed hair. And it came undone when I was 21.
Boy, this song really goes on.
Yeah. It's epic.
What's what?
It's epic.
What does this song mean to you?
Well, only an older man could have ever recorded this song, because you have to come to terms with when I was 35.
Right.
It was a very good year. It was a very good year. For blue-blooded girls of independent means, we'd ride in limousines. Their chauffeurs would drive. When I was 35. I don't know if I got that right, but anyway, those were the words. But you have to be an older man in order to... And the thing that was amazing about Frank's career is that he was always pitch perfect with finding the ways, the moments of demarcation.
Yep.
This song was like, when it came to him and when he got to record it, it was flawlessly timed for, because right after this he decided to retire. Now, he didn't stay retired, but he retired for like 3 or 4 years. And it was like, yeah, I've reached the point where, you know, this verse, you can read it, because we've already blown the...
Oh, yeah, we're well into it.
From the brim to the dregs.
That's it. I'm from the brim to the dregs.
It poured sweet and clear.
It was a very good year.
Well, it was a very good year, Ron, and this was a very good time.
It continues to be. It's only November, for Christ's sake. Don't wish my life away, goddamn. You have the Thanksgiving tree up. It's not even Christmas yet.
Good to see you, Ron Perlman.
Good to see you, Chris.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. It's wrapped in fine tortilla. There's meat and cheese inside, and maybe some lettuce. Hold the onions for me. I gotta go pee.
When you were 23.
Ron, your catheter.
Ow! Shit, that was one fine pee.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.